Quaker.com podcast. Today is Thursday, November 15th, 2012, and this is podcast number 230. My name is Ben Stone, and we're shifting some things around a little bit at badquaker.com. At the end of every podcast, now I've been doing this podcast for, what, a year and a half, something like that, and at the end of every podcast, I would say, for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. And sometimes I'd say it right, and sometimes I'd interchange them or goof it up in one way or the other, but that was basically the tagline for this podcast. And it appears that now that we're going to shift that. Well, it more than appears. It's about to happen. Boom, there it happens. See it? Badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission, is now going to be the tagline. And, you know, I was a little concerned about leaving behind discussion of property rights, liberty, and the zero aggression principle, at least as a tagline. We're still going to, you know, discuss these things with guests and Kai and I here on the podcast, and even when I'm doing the podcast by myself, you know, it's still going to be focused on liberty, property rights, and zero aggression. But I'm really starting to play around with this concept of liberty as our mission. Of course, you can't have liberty without an understanding of property and an understanding of zero aggression, or non-aggression, however, whatever you're more comfortable with. But the zero aggression principle is so foundational that, that it's really impossible to create a consistent, I don't want to say theology. That's not really right, although in a way it is right. And I don't want to say philosophy, because in a way that's right, but in a way it doesn't serve a big enough purpose. Really, to grasp the depths of what I'm talking about when I say liberty, you really have to take it beyond either theology or philosophy, and you really have to go into a whole new realm of thought with that. Or maybe a combination. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. But anyway, without a full understanding of property and how property works and how property is exchanged voluntarily, entirely within the zero aggression principle, and without understanding that if you have, you know, I talk about tacos and apples a lot. So if you have tacos and I have apples, and you value, you know, an apple as being worth a taco, and so you're willing to exchange with me a taco for an apple. And if I value the same way, then we'll make that exchange. And when we do this, we wouldn't exchange for equal value. We would only exchange, you know, there has to be some greater desire than just for equal. I have to want a taco more than an apple in order to give up an apple. And you have to want an apple more than a taco in order to give up that taco. So when we make this voluntary exchange, and this is the essence of property, so stick with me on this. It's not just random talking about food, but when we make an exchange like this, neither party is harmed. Both parties are enriched. And this is how wealth is created. This is how people interacting voluntarily actually creates wealth. This is the one thing that governments can never do. Governments can never create wealth. They can steal it from one place. They can spend it. They can destroy it. They can give it to somebody else, but they can't create it. Wealth is only created when two human beings voluntarily exchange. And when two people exchange, and it's voluntary, then no harm is done. There is no theft. There is no harm. And if one person says, you know what, I would give up 10 tacos for one apple. If a person says that and they make that exchange voluntarily, then no one else has the right to say that person got ripped off. There's no possible way a taco is worth that. Or there's no possible way apples are worth that. You see, nobody has the right to say that because they weren't the ones exchanging it. Wealth and the value of anything exists only in the mind of the person who possesses them. So I'm not abandoning, talking about property rights, and I'm not abandoning talking about the zero aggression principle. But the only way to obtain liberty, really is through an understanding of property rights and zero aggression principle. And as these three things interact, the zero aggression principle can't happen without an understanding of property rights. And as the zero aggression principle takes place, as we commit ourselves not to aggress on anyone and not to hire anyone to aggress on our behalf, as we understand this and as we understand that aggression happens when one person attempts to steal or harm or interfere with another person's property. So that's what aggression actually is. So these things are all linked together. And liberty develops as a result of this knowledge and as a result of the outworkings of property rights and zero aggression principle. So again, I'm not abandoning that. What I'm saying there in saying this is I think the liberty movement, as a lot of people call it, and I've talked about this a little bit lately, the liberty movement was kind of a faddish thing. There was a fad tendencies to it, and it did. And in many cases, much like the Tea Party movement, in many cases it didn't really have the legs underneath it to accomplish what people really wanted it to do. And the reason why is because, a fad is just a fad. A movement is just a movement. But if liberty becomes your mission, and not a mission impossible, but a mission that you can accomplish, then all of a sudden it takes on a different scope. It's no longer a pie in the sky. Hopefully someday, maybe in the by and by, eventually we might become free. It's not like that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a mission that has a plan, that has an outline, and that has a way that it can be accomplished. Now, that's what I want. I want that kind of a mission for liberty. So I want to talk about that a little bit today. I did want to, I've already gone into this more than I meant to in the intro, but I did want to mention real quick before I get too involved in this whole thing that our forum is up to almost 100 members and it's really growing. I want to thank you very much to all the members that have come in and all the activity, all the chatter. That's really, really good. I don't get to go in and really spend the kind of time that I want to. I'm trying to wean myself from Facebook and get more and more over towards the forum. That's my personal goal. So, I'm working towards that and I want to do a lot of things with the forum that I haven't done yet. I want to put, there's some talk on there about a trip that my wife and I want to make with our motorhome this winter. And I want to expand on that because next year I really want to take the motorhome out to different places, and maybe even arrange smaller meetings here and there with listeners wherever we happen to go in the motorhome journeys next year. And I don't want to necessarily rip off. There was a few years back there was Motorhome Diaries, which was very successful. And a bunch of guys went around in Marv, if you're familiar with the story, and they did a whole bunch of stuff. It was really good. They did a bunch of YouTube videos, and it was really great. Well, that's not necessarily what I want to do, but yeah, it's kind of in a smaller way, I want to do something like that, specifically with Bad Quaker listeners. But anyway, so if you haven't checked it out, check out the forum. Almost 100 members, and a lot of stuff I want to do with it we haven't got to yet, but we're moving in that direction. Okay, so now there's been a lot of talk. Really, it's been going on for years, but it's starting to get a little bit more vocal that I've noticed in the last few months. And I think partially it's because a lot of people are becoming... The whole Ron Paul campaign, there was so much effort and there was so much belief and there was so much hope and there was so much money that was pumped into the Ron Paul campaign and the whole effort to get him into the public eye. And, you know, so many people were hurt so bad when some of the top people in the campaign, when it was revealed that they really weren't they really weren't us, they weren't among us, they weren't our kind, they were really just in it for a quick dollar and for a good political position. A lot of that stuff started getting revealed some months back. And, you know, there was a couple of us that had sort of warned about that. And it did come to pass pretty much like we said. You know, I'm not a real big Adam Kokesh fan, but that's a style differentiation between myself and Adam. It's not that I have anything personally against him. It's just a style, you know, difference. But Adam, very, very openly pointed out some of the serious flaws in the campaign really early on. And others did as well. You know, what the Ron Paul campaign did to Bob Murphy was just terrible. And others too. And I won't go into the whole thing, but it seemed like within a very short period of time, a lot of people understood that all their hopes and dreams and all the money that they spent, and it was all just dashed to the rocks. And so there's a lot of this talk about, well, what do we call ourselves? What are we? If the liberty movement is something that's, you know, not really gonna, it doesn't have direction, it doesn't have legs underneath it, it doesn't have a specific plan other than to get Ron Paul elected to something, well, what good is that? So what really do we call ourselves? You know, some people call what we're doing, some people call it libertarian, some people don't like the word libertarian. You know, it's too often equated. It's too often tied in to the Libertarian Party, which is, you know, they have a lot of problems over there. And I'm saying, you know, I used to be a part of the Libertarian Party. I used to put a lot of effort into it and everything. But they really have some serious problems over there. And some people think of libertarian, they think of the Cato Institute. Well, there's some real serious problems there, especially since in the last, I don't know if you're following this or not, but in the last couple of months, basically, the Cato Institute, through a move of the, you know, of the neocon Koch brothers, it has become basically a wing of the Ayn Rand fanatics, the Randians, and you know, they may have some good concepts, but Rand herself really put down the idea of libertarianism, and she really said some nasty things about libertarianism. So a lot of people don't want to name themselves libertarian and fall into a gap of being, you know, falling in there with the Cato Institute and the Ayn Rand people and the Libertarian Party and people like Bob Barr, you know. Oh my, ex-CIA. Oh, yeah. Anyway, so what do we call ourselves? If libertarian is tainted, anarcho-capitalist, are we anarcho-capitalist? Well, yeah, but there's some problems with that too. And people pick apart the words, and you know, capitalist, some people have a real problem with that. Some people have a problem with the anarcho part of the phrase. Some people would prefer to use the word anarchist. And there's a lot of negative stereotyping that goes with that word. And other people prefer voluntarist or agorist or one of the other phrases like this. And there's a lot of them, you know. And each of them have good points and each of them have bad points. And each of them, you know, draw false conclusions in some people's minds. So what do we do with ourselves? Well, you know, there's not an easy answer to that. And I don't have the answer, but what I can say is that always adjust the message to the ears of the listener. So, for example, I don't know if you've ever been in a rock concert, or I suppose it happens with other concerts as well. I know it happens with pop concerts, but oftentimes the entertainer or the main, like the lead singer or whoever the main person is, they'll be up there on the stage and there's all the energy and the lights and everything that's going on. And they'll say something like, you know, let's say the venue is in Chicago, so they're there in Chicago and they're having a big concert or whatever. And the guy will say, "It's great to be back in Chicago, where I can finally get a decent hot dog and a slice of real pizza." Yeah! And the crowd goes nuts, right? Because all Chicagoans, well, I shouldn't say all, but it's kind of a stereotypical thing with Chicagoans that they know how to make hot dogs. You know, unlike those weird things on the East Coast or whatever that, you know, tofu or whatever that's on the West Coast, Chicago knows how to make a hot dog. And Chicago knows what a real slice of pizza is. I mean, this is kind of a cultural thing around Chicago, and they're very proud of that. But the thing of it is, the rock star that's saying this stuff on the stage will go to Hoboken and say the same thing. And the people in Hoboken go, "Yeah, we know how to make hot dogs. We have real pizza here." And so, you know, so you adjust the message to the ears of the listener. The rock star is doing that because he wants to sell records. He wants to sell records. How old am I, right? Yeah, 50s. So the rock star is doing this because he wants to sell his music, sell his image, sell his marketing merchandise, and he wants you buying tickets to his concert. So that's why he's saying this. That's why he's adjusting his message to the ears of the listener. So if he says that in Chicago about hot dogs and a slice of real pizza, then when he's in Cincinnati, he's going to talk about chili, or he's going to talk about, you know, riverboats. Or if he's in New Orleans, he's going to talk about the different things that New Orleans is famous for. He's going to talk about, like, the French Quarter or whatever, see? And he's adjusting his message to the ears of the listener. I was on the same lines, I was thinking of Paul from the biblical Paul from the New Testament was in Athens. And Paul had learned a lesson kind of in a rough way as he moved from Greek city to Greek city, you know, talking about this message about Jesus and Christianity and so forth. And what he found out was you just march into a city and you go up to their temples and you start, you know, yelling out about how they're a bunch of idolaters and they're all gonna, you know, the typical, procedure like that you might imagine somebody like Paul doing. Well, you end up getting yourself beat with sticks and canes and you get rocks thrown at you and it's not a pretty sight. So at some point in Paul's maturity, he made his way to Athens, and rather than standing in front of the temples and, you know, denouncing all the false gods, instead he went to the altar that was marked for the unknown God. And Paul began sharing a message of the unknown God. And so here he is at the altar of the unknown God, which the Greeks put out because, hey, you want to cover all your bases, right? You don't want to irritate any gods by forgetting somebody. So they had put out among their pantheon and I'm not saying the pantheon that was in Rome, but among the pantheon of gods that the Greeks had put out temples and altars and so forth, they had put out one to the unknown God so that everybody's covered. And so Paul took advantage of this, and he appealed to the Athenians using the same method of argument that they were accustomed to. Not confrontational, but using aspects of logic to get them to think about his points. And so he adjusted the message to the ears of the audience when he did this. And it's really important as you do that, like with the rock star here, talking about, you know, a decent hot dog and a real slice of pizza. Well, words shape thoughts and words drive ideas. So, without actually saying something like, you know, Chicago has the best hot dogs in the world or nobody makes a pizza like they do in Chicago, he doesn't have to get into details on saying why, and he doesn't have to explain to his fans in Chicago why he's saying what he's saying. He's using these words to shape thoughts in their mind that, oh, he's one of us. He understands how good Chicago this is or how good Chicago that is, or the same in Hoboken or the same in New Orleans or the same in Memphis. The rock star is able to use those words to drive ideas into the minds of the listener and shape the thoughts of the listener. And when you're communicating like that with words, keep in mind one other thing about geometry. Words and geometry. But keep this in mind about geometry. If you set out in a straight line to get from point A to point B in a straight line, and if you're off by only a very slight amount, just a couple of degrees, according to how far you have to travel from point A to point B, those few degrees can be dramatically different in the distance of where you're going to strike your target. So, for instance, if you're going from point A to point B, and the two points are fairly close to each other, and you're only off by 1 degree, then you're not going to miss by much when you get there. But if those points are far apart from each other, say one of those points is on Earth and one of those points is on the Moon, and you're off by only a couple degrees, you could miss it by hundreds of miles, thousands of miles. I don't know. I didn't do the math. I'm not good at math. And this is the thing about shaping thoughts and driving ideas with words. If you're not clear, and if you're not using those words in a way that the listener applies directly the way you want, then it's very likely you're going to miss the goal that you're shooting at, and you're going to draw a different picture in their mind than what you intend to do. Okay, stick with me. I'll be right back. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site. All the courses, plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much. Okay, now I was talking about how words shape thoughts and drive ideas. So I want to give a couple of definitions here. And if you're a longtime listener, and you've probably heard this over and over, but stick with me. I'll try to get through this part as quickly as possible. I'm gonna talk about state and government, those two words. And so if you are a longtime listener, you've probably heard me do this, you know, like once a week for as long as you've been listening. But we have a lot of new listeners, so I just want to touch on this and why it's important to distinguish between these two concepts. Even if you don't use the words that I use for them, it's really important to distinguish between these two concepts of state and government. And I'm not trying to give a hard definition that I want Webster's or somebody to adopt. That's not my point. In trying to explain the difference between the concept of state and the concept of government, we're stuck with words that are very imperfect, and they have been used and manipulated, and they've been used by throughout time, you know, and or at least through the English language, time of the English language. So I'm trying to get across something when I describe the state. I'm trying to get across something that I can't find any other word that properly describes it. So I'm stuck taking this word, the state, and whacking it over the head and dragging it down and using it for my purposes, even though other people use it for a lot of different purposes. So I want to make this distinction between the difference between government and state. I view the government as the physical presence. It's the people, it's the buildings, it's the tanks, it's the aircraft carriers, it's the monuments, all those things that can be bought and sold with tax dollars, Even so much as like the lobbyists, all those people who feed off of government in one form or another, who feed off of the tax dollars, or who work within the system to try to manipulate the system to gain advantages for themselves or for their group or whatever. I view all that as the government, the guys with uniforms, the guys with, you know, with that are willing to use the force of government to beat you down, to force you to obey their rules. Those people who will throw you in a cage because you possess the leaf of a plant. That, all that stuff, I believe, is government. But the state is the mythical concept in your mind that that government's aggression is legitimate. And again, words fail me in this, and so I have to just club this word in the head and drag it off for my own means. But, and if I could come up with a better word that described this concept, I would be happy to use it instead of using the state. Because using the state and the government, these two words are used interchangeably so much it makes it very confusing. But I'm stuck. I don't have any other word that's handy. So I capitalize the S in state whenever I refer to this imagined entity, this mythical beast that that makes it legitimate for government to act with aggression. That makes government, which is by its definition a geographical monopoly on violence, that myth, that belief, that superstition, that the government is legitimate and that the government has the right to that geographical monopoly on violence. So we have these two very, very different things. One that exists in real life, in real time, that we see it. That's the government. That's the thing that if you cross it, it will beat you down and throw you in a cage. It's the thing that comes to you and takes 70% of your wealth and destroys most of it and redistributes the rest of it to people who have no right to it whatsoever. That's the government. But the belief system, the religion of the state is that which justifies government. It's that which exists only in the minds of humans to fool us, to make us think that what government is doing is good, rather than pointing our finger at it and saying, that aggression is evil. Your laws are evil. When you try to inflict your will upon others, that's evil. And that's the difference there between state and government, that I think that it's critical that we be able to, whether we use the words I use or not, it's critical that we be able to use whatever words are available to shape the thoughts and drive the ideas of the listener so that they understand these two concepts. Because as you start to understand what the state really is, then you start to realize that it's nothing more than a religion. And it's a religion with no foundation in reality. That it's just based on a small group of thugs, of thieves, of robbers, living off of the rest of society. That's really at its core. And once you grasp that, it's like they say on the internet all the time, that which has been seen cannot be unseen. And that's the truth about really seeing the beast, the state. Okay, so now a couple other words that I want to cover. I want to talk about the difference between liberty and freedom. And oftentimes liberty and freedom are used interchangeably. And I'm guilty of it as well. You know, a lot of times I get excited talking and I'm just rambling on and I just, you know, I use shortcuts in language and I just assume you know what I'm talking about. And everybody does that to one extent or another. But, if for the sake of accuracy and for the sake of being able to get these ideas and concepts across to people, the better we can refine what we're saying and be able to understand the nuances and the differences of what we're saying. You know, it's back to those degrees again. If we're shooting at a target and, yeah, well, liberty and freedom, what's the difference? Yeah, whatever. Well, if there are slight degrees of difference, and that's a long distance to get to where we want to go, then even that small amount of difference can make a difference once you get to the destination. And that's one of the problems with liberty. Liberty is not really about a destination. Liberty is a lot more like a journey. I'm going to read to you a definition from for liberty, and this is actually from Google. The primary definition for liberty is listed by Google currently. Who knows what it'll bring tomorrow, but the current definition says, the state of being free within society from oppressive restrictions imposed by authority on one's way of life. All right, I'm going to read it one more time. This is liberty from Google. The state of being free within society from oppressive restrictions imposed by authority on one's way of life. Okay, now here's the definition of freedom from Google. Freedom, the power or right to act, speak, or think as one wants without hindrance or restraint. And now what I want to show to you here is that one is sort of a thing that liberty, it almost requires an adversary. Liberty is, okay, again, being free within society from oppressive restrictions imposed by authority. You see, if you take the authority out of the figure, and if you don't allow an authority who has the opportunity to restrict you through oppression, then you've eliminated, you know, three quarters of the definition of liberty. And what do you have left? You have freedom. So liberty is the journey to freedom. Liberty becomes the mission. It's not the goal. Liberty is how we get from point A to point B, and all the nuances that are involved in that. But freedom has to be the goal, and I'll go into freedom more in just a minute. Let me just point out a couple more things about liberty first, though. Here's a couple of examples. Let's say you want to grow something. You want to grow a plant. Well, currently in the U.S., most people in the U.S. are at liberty to grow, let's say, a tomato plant. Even if you're not very good at growing a tomato plant, even if you live in an apartment, even if you live under restricted circumstances, in many cases, you can still grow a tomato plant. You may not produce, there's no guarantees you may not produce any tomatoes, but you're at liberty to try anyway. But you're not at liberty to, let's say, grow certain breeds of poppies. It's against the law in the United States for you to try to grow certain types of poppies. Now, the reason why is because, you know, poppies can be used in the production of opiates. And so the government restricts the growing of poppies in the United States. As a matter of fact, most governments around the world restrict the growth of this type of poppies. Many governments who gladly look the other way for other drugs, other banned plants like marijuana or whatever. Many other governments will look the other way when it comes to marijuana plants. But you start having serious poppy production, and it will get their attention really quick. So you're at liberty to grow tomatoes, but you're not at liberty to grow poppies. You can use your existing liberties, however, to obtain more liberty. How can we do that? Well, let's think about the tomatoes and the poppies. If you can grow tomatoes in your backyard, or if you can grow tomatoes in a bucket on a balcony, then you can learn the skill of growing things. And if you can learn the skill of growing things, you can grow other things. And if you really get into it good, you can learn to grow things that you're not allowed to grow. And here's one little trick. And I've said this for years and years and years. You know, The group of people in American society that are typically in a derogatory fashion referred to as hippies, you know, you tend to think of people who are pro marijuana or pro, you know, that use marijuana or whatever. A lot of people in society will look down their nose at them and call them things like hippies or whatever. But if these people, whatever we want to call them, if they were industrious and really wanted to, to throw a monkey wrench in the war on drugs, then all they would have to do is start very quietly raising marijuana for the purpose of seed production. And they would start raising them everywhere they can. City parks, Bureau of Land Management owns massive tracts of land in the West. I think, if I recall, Nevada, something like 90-some percent of Nevada is controlled by Bureau of Land Management, federal government. In other words, it's federal government land. Well, if pro-pot people would learn skills of growing tomatoes and then start spreading the Johnny Appleseed type, just start spreading marijuana seeds everywhere where the state doesn't actively mow or where they don't actively control areas. And don't go back. The purpose of this is not to go and harvest the marijuana leaves. No, the purpose is to use closer to native and wild breeds of the plant and literally just have it growing everywhere. Now, this is a way that a liberty that you have to grow tomatoes could set up a situation where the government wouldn't be able to stop the production of marijuana. How can you have something outlawed if it's as common as, say, dandelions? You see what I'm saying? The government, there's no possible way they could outlaw dandelions. And marijuana will grow just as easily. So liberty with your tomato plants can bring you liberty for your pot plants. And I'm not advocating the use of marijuana. I don't smoke marijuana. I don't have anything to do with it. I don't have it in my house. I'm just saying. Okay, so now, so you can use existing liberty to obtain more liberty. I gave you that one example, but I don't have time to go into 20 or 30 more. But you can use liberty to gain more liberty. And as liberty succeeds, the need for the belief in the state begins to die. Now, liberty, to a large extent, is wrapped up in independence. The more independent you can be, the more you begin to understand how important liberties are. And the more independent you become, and the more you understand how important liberties are, the more you realize you don't need the belief in the state. You don't need that myth anymore. You don't need that crutch of the religion of the state. But there's one thing to keep solidly in mind. It's impossible to promote liberty by aggression. So everything I'm saying here about spreading seeds and about using liberties that you have in order to obtain more liberty, the one thing that will not work and cannot work is to attempt to use aggression to promote liberty. It's opposite concepts. So I've spent plenty of time talking before about using the aggression of government to bring liberty, or using the vote, or using any other form of aggression to promote liberty. You get the opposite result, because that's all government can ever do. It can only produce negative results, because government is evil, and you can't do two bad things and come up with a good thing, or three bad things and come up with a good thing. A bad can only produce bad. So you have to embrace non-aggression to promote liberty. And as you do that, as you expose aggression, the act of exposing aggression promotes liberty. So, for instance, think of when Eddie Free and the other folks were down at the Jefferson Memorial, and they expressed liberty in dancing. Now, they knew what would happen, and what happened was that the government cracked down on them, threw them to the ground, handcuffed them, manhandled them, pushed them around, and this shined a light on unnecessary and even silly, absurd aggression. This is what was made blatantly obvious by Eddie Free and the others that did this. Now, this is, of course, a form of protest, and you have to be extremely careful with protest because, you know, if the protest involves aggression, you're not going to produce a positive result. And if the protest produces, permanent imprisonment, or if the protest produces martyrdom, then you have a negative consequence. You can't... if you're dead or in jail, you can't do any more promoting of liberty. Most of your liberties are going to be taken away. You won't even get to grow a tomato plant in all likelihood. So again, you can utilize certain liberties that we have to expose the aggression of government. And when the absurdity of that aggression is exposed, then it becomes easier for other people to look. And they see just how goofy this religion of the state really is. And so these are These are the way that liberty becomes our mission. It becomes an active thing that we do, not just a club where we hang out, or not just a loose association where all of our friends are doing it, so we're doing it too. None of that fad type stuff, but it becomes a mission. It becomes something that burns in our soul that we have to get to, that we have to accomplish. And it's not impossible. It's imperative. It's imperative for our species as we begin to understand more and more how wretched and horrible this religion of the state really is. And this beast that is the state, as we begin to see him for what he really is and what his goals and desires really are, it's not that hard to understand that it is imperative for our species that the state die, that the myth of the state become as effective as the myth of Thor or the myth of Hercules. It becomes something that, you know, children tell tales about, but nobody would ever actually believe in anymore. And that's what we have to move towards, that level. When liberty gets to that point, then we will have freedom, because there will be no more state. Okay, now when I get back, I'm going to go into freedom.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. Okay, thanks for sticking with me. Now, I was talking about liberty, and I'm about to move into the discussion of freedom. But I want to just recap real quick. For the mission of liberty to work, we must use existing liberties to create a market demand for more liberties. Liberty exercised releases the power of the market. Governments then will react to the market with aggression. That's what they always do. And we can point to the absurdity of that aggression. And this acts to expose the myth of the state, and it sparks the desire for freedom. So the exercise of liberty exposes the absurdity of the state and sparks a desire for freedom. Okay, now I'm going to read this definition for freedom one more time. Freedom, the power or right to act, speak, or think as one wants without hindrance or restraint. Now, we have to add a slight disclaimer to that, because there are restraints on freedom. There are restraints on what we speak and think and want to do. For instance, I can't levitate. I cannot, of my own will, levitate. It's against the law, so to speak, for me to levitate. It's against the real laws for me to levitate. I can't just look at something on the other side of the room and draw it to my hand through my will. I can't do that. It violates laws. Not laws that men wrote, and not laws that some decided upon, but real laws. Real laws limit the individual, but it does not limit freedom. So when I read that definition, the power or right to act, speak, or think as one wants without hindrance or restraint, you have to leave that within the natural realm and understand that according to science and according to physics and according to the realm of existence that we dwell in, there are hindrances and restraints and limitations and laws. But that's totally different from these made-up fake laws that humans come up with and then inflict upon one another using aggression. So our only real limitations in to a truly free society, the only real limitations are those placed upon us by nature. And again, the zero aggression principle and property rights follow natural law. They follow through. And I've gone before, I've talked about, you know, how each species of animals has specific laws built into them that they function through and they follow. And they do this in order for their species to perpetuate. So whether we're talking about, you know, ducks that fly north and south, or whether we're talking about, you know, whales that hunt fish in a particular way, or whether we're talking about squirrels that gather nuts for the winter, animals are restricted to laws that are very unique to each of their species and subspecies and so forth. And so are humans. Humans are, you know, there's no logical reason to think that if a butterfly is driven to leave the forests of Mexico and fly all the way to the plains of Canada, and if he has to do that, if that's part of his nature that he has to do it, then there's probably things like that within humanity that drive our behavior and reward good behavior and punish bad behavior. And so discovering those is discovering natural law. And we discover things like property rights and the zero aggression principle by understanding natural law. So freedom does not mean without limits. It does not mean without any hindrance or restraint. It means staying within the restraints and the limits that are unique to our species and that are unique to science. But it means not being held down by the will of other humans placed upon us just simply to fulfill their desires at our cost. So you can't have freedom and still have the state exist. The belief in the state has to be completely gone for you to have true freedom, because the belief in the state is the belief that some people can make up laws and inflict them upon you and live off of you. So these two things are not compatible. You see, back with liberty, the state could still exist. And as a matter of fact, within the liberty mission, we use the state. We use the absurdity and the violence and the threats of violence and all the aggression of the state. We use that absurdity and we point to it, and we use that to show people that what's inside their minds is a flawed religion. But freedom is once we get past that. Once freedom arrives, the state is gone. And there are no degrees of freedom. We're either free or we're not. I've talked before about a dog on a leash. If you have a dog on a 10-foot leash, hey, that dog's got a pretty good leash. But if you have a dog on a 20-foot leash, that dog is not more free. He's still on a leash. He's still a dog on a leash. He's not free. If there are restrictions on him by his master, he's not free. So he might be in different states of liberty, but he's not free so long as that leash is hanging around his neck, holding him back. But now here's the thing about freedom. You think about a wolf. You think about how would it look if you were to take your dog's leash and you were to find a sleeping wolf in the forest and you were to carefully sneak up on it. I know it can't happen, but if you carefully sneak up on this wolf and you very quietly and carefully latch that dog's collar around that wolf's neck, and you give that leash a tug, and you say, "Hey, boy, wake up." What do you think that wolf is going to do? Do you think the wolf is free? Do you think he's limited by his liberties? The wolf is going to do everything he can do to break free from you. And in his mind, and here's the difference between the dog and the wolf. The dog is captive, whether or not he has the leash. The dog understands and accepts his condition. But the wolf will not. The wolf that's been in the wild his whole life, you cannot convince this wolf that you are no longer free. The wolf will do everything within his power to return to his free state, because in his mind, he's still free. In his mind, you have not captured him. And do you know how he knows that you have not captured him? Because he's still breathing and he still has life, and he's going to fight until he's not breathing and until he has no life. Think about a different situation. A horrible, horrible thing happens when you set out leg snares or leg traps and you get a coyote or a fox, something like that, all canines we're talking about here. If you get a coyote or a fox caught in a leg trap, and it's true also with a wolf, but either way, it's just devastating, because what they'll often do is they'll literally gnaw their leg off to get free, because in their mind they are free, and this thing that's holding them back will not stand between them and freedom. So they will literally chew their own leg off in order to be free. And that's one of the really horrible things about a leg snare when you're talking about a predator. Now, it's a different thing when you catch a rabbit with his leg snare. He has a whole different set of thoughts go through his mind. But you cannot make a wolf not free. You can kill it, but you can't make the wolf not free. Now, you can capture a baby wolf that doesn't know any different, and you can raise him as a dog, and if you fit certain criteria in the way you raise him, then in a sense you've created a dog. But if that wolf is free in his mind, you will never have a dog. You will always have a wolf. So then, freedom is made up of two separate concepts. There's the freedom of the mind, and there's the freedom of the body. And think about, I've talked before about the falcon. You think about a bird's in a cage. You got a couple Tweety birds in a cage, and you give them a bigger cage, they're not free. You give them an even bigger cage, they're still not free. You give them a cage so big they can't find the edge of it. They may think they're free. They may feel like they're free. In every way, practicality, they may appear to be free, but they're not free. They're still in a cage. Now you think of the falconer, and the falconer raises by hand, he raises this falcon from right after it comes out of the egg, he hand feeds it, he talks to it, he keeps it right there on his arm until it becomes big enough that he can, and he trains it, and he loves it, and he never harms it, and it becomes big enough that he can release it, and it goes out and flies and does his bidding and comes back to him and lands back on his hand. That falcon is not free. The falcon is as much bound as the dog on the chain. The difference between the falcon and the wolf that I was talking about is the falcon doesn't realize his capabilities, and he doesn't realize what freedom is. So you might argue that the falcon, once he takes to wing, is free because he can fly, but he's not. He's captive in his mind, because that's really where the battle has to begin, in the mind. You can never be free in your body until you first realize that a wolf cannot be made captive, and a fox cannot be made captive. And that same falcon, if you capture it as an adult, and it's already tasted freedom, you will never, ever, ever have a captive falcon. Every time you let go of him to do your bidding, he's gone. Once the mind grasps freedom, the myth of the state evaporates. And once the mind grasps freedom and rejects the myth of the state, the advance towards liberty almost becomes an obsession. The advance of liberty, I should say, almost becomes an obsession. That mission of liberty, once your mind grasps the concept of freedom, the march, the liberty march, that liberty mission almost becomes an obsession. Almost, well, I don't know. Maybe more than becomes an obsession. So now, what do we do when we take all these things together? When we think about freedom and we get a grasp and an understanding that freedom is really two parts. It's that which is in the mind and that which is in the body. And liberty is the vehicle, it's the mission, it's how we're going to get to freedom. And so once we take these two concepts and we say, all right, now what we need is a practical plan of action. And I used to say, all the time, people would ask me, especially in the Ron Paul campaign when it was really at its height. And I was saying, don't give your money to the Ron Paul campaign. Don't spend your time on the Ron Paul campaign. Don't vote. When I was saying those things, the response would often be, well, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? If we're not going to do that, we can't just sit around and do nothing. That's what you want to do. You want to just do nothing. And I often times would just stop the conversation at that point because that person was not ready to hear what I'm about to tell you. And I was told that over and over, and very often I would just stop the conversation and move on. Or I would say, there's something You just don't see it yet. Keep trying, you'll see it. And here is the plan of action for the mission of liberty. And this plan is like seeking the Holy Grail. The mission of liberty is done on an individual basis. I want to focus on two aspects today of this mission of liberty. And that is to know yourself and to know your enemy. Anytime, this is an old Sun Tzu thing, anytime you're going to face any kind of combat, whether it be, in a chess game or whether it's out on the field of battle, it's imperative to know yourself and know your enemy. So self, let's go with that first. A journey of self-examination and honesty is absolutely the most difficult thing that you're going to face, but that's what we have to do. Each of us has to go on a journey of self-examination and honesty. We have to learn our strengths and our weaknesses. We have to know our limitations. We have to understand physical limitations, family obligations, financial limitations, and time restraints. And as you begin to examine these things in your own life, your own individual quest, as you begin to understand yourself through self-examination and just, you know, real hard honesty, really looking at yourself and really saying, can I do this? Can I put this kind of time into that? What kind of result will this project do if I pour myself into it? And as you really start to take these things seriously in self-examination and honesty, becomes what you're dedicated to, then you can begin to know yourself and you can begin to know how you can battle this beast for yourself in your own quest, in your own mission of liberty. And next is to know the enemy. So how do we get to know such an evil monster? How do we get to know that which we don't even dare really make eye contact with? Well, the thing to keep in mind is you never fight an enemy on the battlefield of his choosing, using the weapons of his choice, at the time he expects you to fight. You seek your enemy's weaknesses, and you seek to understand your enemy's strengths. Because unless you understand what your enemy is good at, then you can end up walking right into something that can be detrimental. So we have to understand not only the enemy's strengths, but the enemy's weaknesses. Use avenues that your enemy has overlooked. Remember, I was talking there a minute ago about learning to grow tomatoes so that you can learn to grow other things and then spread those seeds. Think of it also as the saying, if you set your enemy's house on fire, he'll put it out. But if you set small fires in each of his fields, he'll be busy and you can loot his house. You know, the governments of the world have looted us for long enough. It's time that we find and exploit every weakness of government, everywhere. We need to, like Paul, we need to dance on their altars. We need to put on a show for them. But we need to find the weaknesses, and we need to sow weed seeds in their gardens. I was thinking about something George Herbert Walker Bush said back in 1988. Papa Bush, I like to derogatorily call him, because his son I refer to as Baby Bush. So Papa Bush used to say, he used to talk about these 1,000 points of light. And in 1988 at the Republican convention, I believe it was, he made the speech where he said that if he was elected president in 1988, he would keep America moving forward, always forward, for a better America, for an endless enduring dream, and 1,000 points of light. And oh, the Republicans would cheer and wave their hands. Woohoo! Well, how about 1,000 brush fires of the mind lighting up the most productive fields the state possesses? Freeing people's minds from the myth of the state. How about getting in to people's minds, using what liberties that we possess to get into people's minds and let them see what the state really is, to light little fires? Samuel Adams said, "It does not require a majority to prevail, but rather an irate and tireless minority, keen to set brush fires in the minds." As we do this, we create a market. We create a market for liberty. And the more we utilize that market, the more we begin to expose the state. And then at some point in time, the fire lights. And through that light, people get a glimpse of what the state really is, and they reject it. BadQuaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks, folks.